everyone.
Love
this is Leon.
Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Leona Brando, New Vision Organization, and Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are going to be, this afternoon, we are going to be continuing our discussion of why prisoners are being prevented from achieving while in prison, why they are being targeted, set up, lied about, and denied access to programs. Where is the accountability? Our previous guest and author of The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment, Joe G.K., is back with us today in our second series of his story and more on his book about inequality, racism, and injustice between the elite and the average citizens. We have Joe G.K. on the line with us now. Are you with us, Joe?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We are continuing from our last episode, and I'd like you again maybe to just update everyone on the book and yourself, and what led you to writing the book, The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment.
Yeah, I've been an activist for over 60 years, concerned about peace and social justice, and tragically, my wife was dying of cancer, and I couldn't go. I had to be her caregiver. I couldn't go out anymore and do the political work I had been doing. So I thought that one thing I could do is to write a book, stay home and write a book. And to me, the most important issue at the moment, and I still believe it to be, was the question of white supremacy, which is intimately and inextricably connected to the social system we live in, the capitalist system. They were born together here. And what I saw as the principal lever of this white supremacy was a whole series of stereotypes, lies, myths about African American people, and in particular, in the recent decades, the alleged criminality of African American men and increasingly African American women. And so that myth has served to shift the acceptance of that myth has served to shift the politics all the way to the right, and today we have Trump as the, hopefully the final expression, but who knows? So I decided to write a book about these myths and to blow up those myths and to show who the real criminals in our society are. So I'm 87 years old. I'm a European American, also what people sometimes call a white man. And I have found, and I have studied a great deal of U.S. history, which means I've studied a great deal of African American history, which is what the U.S. history is really largely about. And I come to the conclusion that the African American presence in the United States is central to understanding our history, that as both as objects and as subjects, they have been the source of the enrichment and the fantastic economic development and prosperity of this country. As objects, they have been used for political purposes to divide working people and to encourage in all people a very reactionary understanding of politics. And as subjects, I found that they have been the catalyst for virtually every single important advance in this country's political history They have been, and especially, for example, in the 60s, when the Black Freedom Movement became the catalyst for so many other movements, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the movement of the elderly, the ecological movement, I could go on and on, the Puerto Rican movement, Latinos. So, and this, unfortunately, is, even on the left, especially among European Americans, is not appreciated. They and given all this understanding, I also came to the understanding that if we're going to have fundamental social change, which is absolutely essential if we're going to really have a just society, that African Americans will be in the forefront of that struggle. And again, we find so often, even on the left, European Americans who are unwilling to accept that kind of leadership of people of color generally, and of African Americans in particular.
As I say, I bought your book, and I've been reading some of it, and I haven't had a chance to really get into it, the entire book. But the crime of impunity, the crime of punishment, you've done a lot of cross-referencing. You've done a lot of research into all of this as well. And what really fascinates me is the fact that this is going on today, right before our eyes with the government, with all of these allegations coming out, all of this injustice coming out, all of these women coming forth with all of these things that have been going on with these politicians and with their employers and all the things that have been going on there. There's so much going on with the corruptions coming out right out in the open. And this recently, even with the Bill Cosby incident, these men are all being accused, and the one that actually went into prison is the Bill Cosby case. Not to say that he shouldn't be serving time, but it's to say that others should also be serving time, because these are the injustices that have been going on, and these are the people that have gotten away with so much because they are of the elite. They are of the more sophisticated or educated or whatever progressive ones. So that's
yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In reading the book, I mean, it is so it's fascinating because it's everything that I'm reading about in past times, in present times, is actually occurring before our eyes. So anyone who reads this book can actually relate to it because it's going on right before us.
Yeah. So I talk about basically the double standard, which is what I think you're talking about too.
Definitely.
And the double standard in the second part of the book, The Crime of Punishment, you know, shows that, for example, Black people are accosted by the police at far greater rates than their numbers should warrant. They are arrested in far greater numbers than they should be. They are then, once arrested, they are sentenced. You know, the prosecutors decide to go forward and try them in far greater numbers, even for the same crime as whites are charged with. The black people go to trial at a far greater rate than their numbers would warrant for the same crimes or alleged crimes, and then they are sentenced to much heavier sentences. The whites get far more consideration in terms of probation and parole. So there's that double standard, but there's even a more, infinitely more monstrous double standard, which is that the way corporations and the rich are treated when they commit infinitely greater crimes than the ordinary street criminal. So the person who steals $15 at a gas station, like George Jackson, who became a political prisoner, was sentenced from 1 year to 30 years and wound up dying in prison, being killed in prison, and after spending many, many years. While people who steal billions of dollars, such as the banks and all the swindles that went on that caused the great economic crash in 2008, which resulted in more than 3 million people losing their homes, and losing their jobs, These people didn't serve one day in prison. You have the people who make OxyContin, and the people who become addicted to it, they wind up in prison, and the manufacturer doesn't serve one single day of time. And then there's the standard where the judge, I quote a judge in the book, who see, you know, the prominent person there who has been arrested and convicted, and the judge decides he's not going to sentence him to prison time because he's suffered enough, you know, his reputation, his prestige, and he doesn't belong in prison. Whereas
there are many that don't belong in prison, but as you say, this is an incident where someone is getting away with it, while the less fortunate are not able to get away from the sentencing to the incarceration.
Right, and here's another thing. You know, when you commit a crime and are convicted, you get usually if it's a first time offense, it's usually the sentence is light. Then if you come back again, they increase the sentence, and then finally they throw the book at you. Whereas you have a Wells Fargo, a bank, who has been convicted and pled guilty to five major plunder, major crimes involving billions of dollars, and despite the fact that they have now, for the fifth time, been found guilty of that, they haven't and will not serve one day in prison. Whereas, again, I say somebody who steals a few dollars, or even some food, which I saw even in my neighborhood, some poor young man, he had, I don't know, a box of food of some kind, $3 or $4. The cops surrounded him and put him in handcuffs, and he was going to definitely go to prison. So it's, and you take murder, for example. Now, murder is a heinous crime, but the person who commits one murder, and by the way, is then called for the rest of his life a murderer, as if that's the only thing about that person that characterizes that person. But you have people, you have the politicians and the business and the corporations who make tons of money from wars, unleashing these wars on people all around the world, and millions of people are killed. And nobody is called a criminal for those murders, and instead are given medals or become enriched, and so on. So,
or they're promoted.
They're promoted. So this, what I'm saying is that this, enormous. So therefore, when I get to the people in prison, I say they should not be apologetic. They have and they should understand that they may have victimized if they engaged in some violence against others in the community. They have victimized others, but they have been themselves victimized by this society, and that the media has conspired to create a hysteria about street crime. And especially black street crime, you know, the perp walk to the perpetrator. You see on nightly television, usually a black man led away in handcuffs, but you never see any of these corporate criminals who do infinitely worse ever referred to as perpetrators. Never see pictures of their being in handcuffs and so on. So
no, you don't.
So my thing, we have to stop being apologetic about those people who are serving or have served. And by the way, you know that we have at least 65 million people with criminal records now in this country. Maybe it's even up to 100 million. What kind of a society is it where we have, and then we have millions of people engaged in being correction officers and guards of one kind or another, and police officers. What kind of a society we live in that where we have spend so much, have so many people involved in suppressing and repressing other people?
You know what really upsets me too is that there are a lot of police shootings nowadays. Not just police shooting others and minorities, but also police being killed. And the thing that bothers me is the police officers that are really trying, that are really good, that are really out in the communities trying to do something positive and right and not corrupt. They will not disclose or expose their corrupt peers. And because of that, people are becoming so hateful of police officers. And I believe that's why the number of police murders are escalating, because people are getting tired of being abused themselves. They're being targeted, and they're getting to the point where there's a lot of them out there that are, because of that anger, because of that frustration that they're getting away with it, I believe that has a lot to do with the escalation of the shootings. I believe the good police officers, people that are really in law enforcement, that are really trying to do the right thing, should come forth, and they should expose their peers who are out there taking bribes, who are out there murdering, who are out there doing all these other things that they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, what happened?
So by them holding off, like I say, one person said one time, if you know there's something wrong in your department and you don't report it, then you're just as bad as the rest of them. And that's basically what it is.
Yep. Butch, do you remember Serpico? Is that before your time?
No, I remember something about that. I'm not as familiar as you probably are, but I remember hearing something on that.
I think he was a detective sergeant, and he did just what you said. He blew the whistle on the terrific corruption. And, you know, when we speak about corruption of the police force, we just don't mean people on the take, you know, cops on the take and what,
right.
and taking advantage of streetwalkers and so on. But these are, you know, every act of brutality is a corruption. Now, he blew the whistle, you know, and when they plant evidence on defendants and so on. You heard about test lying, have you, in court, what the cops do when they get on a stand. It's so widespread, it's called test lying instead of testifying. So he blew the whistle, and he had to leave the country because his life was so put in jeopardy. It's because it's not just a matter, you know, there's an organized system. It's not just a few rotten apples. Furthermore, even if, you know, we used to think, well, if we could put more black cops in the force, because at the one time they were all white, at least in New York, they were all white. So we said, well, we want more black. We want them to reflect the community. So they started hiring more, still very underrepresented. But what we find is that even black cops turn blue. And that's
exactly
the color that guides them, because they want to show that they're part of the gang, part of the, you know, that they're can be trusted and sometimes, by the way, when a cop does not cooperate with the corruption, what they do is they set them up to be killed.
Exactly.
Not by themselves, but let's say they'll do a raid on a drug operation. And they send that cop that they want to get rid of to lead the charge, and he gets blown away. So the thing is, the institution is more powerful. Yes, there are plenty of cops who are loving family members and go to church or whatever and give contributions to charity. But when they're part of an apparatus, a repressive apparatus, and that's what the police are there for. They're there to protect the property and the lives of the rich, and to keep down any kind of social tension, you know, which is why, you know, if a young black man speaks to a cop in not the most respectful manner, he'll be knocked down. As I used to say, one of the last things you might say to a cop is, "I know my rights," and the next thing you remember, you know, you're in the hospital when you wake up. So the institution is there for bad purposes, and they're there to suppress and repress. And so even good people who want to make a difference and want to help the community, The system just runs over them, and either they cooperate with the system or they'll get in big trouble.
We had some cases advocating for prisoners. We had a police officer from Alabama who had exposed his peers in the police force, and he was set up. He ended up dying in prison several years ago, but he was set up, and he ended up getting a life without parole. And then there was a CIA agent. He's right in New York, in Demerara. And he was exposing or telling his superiors about the corruption and the abuses going on in the force, and he was set up. He's still in Demerara prison. He's been there for some time. So these are people that have actually tried to do the right thing, and they
and
did
by
get
the way,
set up.
While there may be a little uptick in the killing of police by outsiders, I think it's also been overblown, because every time a cop kills a young black or Latino man, the excuse is we feared for our lives. And according to the courts, the Supreme Court, if you fear for your life, you have a legitimate right to shoot and kill. So, but I've, looked at statistics, and of all things, I find that a gardener is more dangerous than a police job, and that there are about a dozen other categories of jobs. Farmer, for example, construction worker, these are far more dangerous than being a policeman. So I think that we shouldn't allow ourselves to think that the cop's job is so frightening that they become trigger happy. They
you're
have
right.
no just.
At your age and my age, going back, do you remember in past years where police officers never had to kill a person? They could shoot them in the leg or the arm or even the hand or whatever. But when did it become that necessary to start shooting people in the back?
Maybe it's when the Black Freedom Movement became a menace to the people on top. You're absolutely right. Police were trained to disable, not to kill.
That's
to shoot them in the legs and things. And now it's the other way around. It seems like the instructions are you shoot to kill. That's your first obligation. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Police were in shape back then, too. If you notice, they're not anymore. They hire them. A lot of them, to me, are really not trained. Like, as you say, they're not experienced. That's why I say there is so much in your book that I find fascinating. And I'm still looking through it. I'm still reading it. And the more I read, the more I learn. And it's like I said, it's not just from the past years. It's going on today right before our eyes. And this gives us an idea of how it started, where it's at, and where it's going.
Every time I pick up the newspaper, I see something that's an example of what I wrote in the book, and even more egregious, even worse. If I ever put out a second edition on the book, I have so much material which makes it even clearer the points I was trying to make in the first book. Yes, things are getting worse.
Yes.
So, the crime, but here's I have certain reservations about the direction we're moving in terms of trying to reform this system. I find that people feel so overwhelmed by how big the problem is, a criminal justice system, for example, that they say, well, I'll just take a tiny piece of this, and that's all I can do as an individual. I can't deal with the whole system. But when we try to deal with just little pieces of it, we'll find that because we're not dealing with the whole system, that what we do really doesn't help very much.
No.
I remember, for example, when the police, that summer, and the police were shooting down people left and right, and all kind of people came forward and said, well, we need cameras on the police, cameras on the police. That will solve everything. So they put cameras on the cops. And what happened? The police have ways of manipulating those things. They turn off the camera when it's inconvenient, turn it back on when it's convenient, or they say something went wrong with the camera, it broke down, and so on. And so nothing has really changed with the cameras. And then they talk about community, getting closer to the cops and community relations, you know, and getting the community to come into the police stations and stuff like that. And all that, you know, all that does, all they're trying to do is to make snitches out of the community, you know, to win the confidence of the community so that they can get, develop informants. So there are just a whole lot of things. And then when we get a reform, for example, in sentencing, at one time you had sentencing like 5 years. Okay, that's your sentence. 5 years. Well, the people just saw that this was being done with discrimination against people of color. So that, for example, black people would get the 5 year sentences and maybe the whites would get a 2 year sentence. So
now it's life.
They came to say, well, let's have a different kind of a system, where you give discretion to the judge. The judge can say 2 to 5 or 2 to 8 or something like that. But that's turned against black people and people of color generally. So whatever reform we try to put in, it's turned against it in exactly the opposite way. It's like... back in the 1890s and stuff, when the monopolies, big monopolies like the steel and oil and other monopolies were growing into, you know, becoming this huge enterprises, and the people started to rebel because they were being paying too much for the products or taxed too much, and the railroads were charging too much to the farmers. You got a big movement, an anti-monopoly movement, and sure enough, they passed what they call the Sherman Antitrust Act. And for years, that act, which was passed to try to curb the power of the monopoly corporations, for years it was used against labor unions. It was used in exactly the opposite way in which it was intended. So even when we try to get, and even when we win a reform, and oftentimes it takes us so many years to gain some little reform, and overnight we get a new president or something, and he rolls back everything that we worked so hard for years. Overnight, it's all gone.
So we're getting ready to close now. So I'd like to, we're going to continue this conversation, this discussion tomorrow, the September 28th at 3:30 p.m. Joe K. will be back on with us to finish updating us and to finish our conversation that we're having today. Joe, it's a pleasure having you on, and I look forward to you being on with us tomorrow as well. Thank you so much.
Okay, and tomorrow I'd like to talk about the criminal justice system more directly.
Please do.
Thank you.
Okay, we're
Thanks
signing off now, and thank you so much, Joe, for being with us.
For inviting me. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow at 3:30. Thank you.